Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
In June 1940, Britain's new Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, faced a dark reality. Hitler's war machine had smashed through Western Europe. The British Army had just made a hasty, bitter retreat home from Dunkirk, France. Great Britain was isolated and next on Hitler's attack list. On June 4, 1940, Britain's new Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, tried to rally the nation in a speech to the House of Commons.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
What Churchill didn't say was how dirty that fight would be and how little faith he had at that time in conventional military action. Churchill had created a top-secret organization, an eclectic group of engineers and innovators who worked around the clock to design and plan bold acts of sabotage and guerrilla warfare, to attack Hitler's supply lines and factories. Writer Giles Milton sheds light on this less well-known side of Britain's war effort in his new book, Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, The Mavericks Who Plotted Hitler's Defeat. Giles Milton joins us now from London. Giles, welcome, and start with Churchill. He was a pillar of the establishment, a man seeped in conventional military thinking. How did he come to embrace unconventional warfare?
He was a pillar of the establishment, but he also, throughout his career, he'd always supported the maverick, the eccentric, the unusual. And I think in the summer of 1940, he realized that because there was no hope of tackling the Nazi war machine head on, then he needed to think of more eccentric solutions to this grave crisis that was facing the country. He began to turn to people who could dream up these creative solutions to trying to destroy or at least hit back in some small way at Hitler's army.
Let's look at some of the men who played key roles in this and who were thinking outside the box. Start with Cecil Clark, who had a mechanical engineering background.
He is one of the most extraordinary members of Churchill's inner circle. He had a highly devious brain. He was able to think outside the box in modern parlance. And he came to Churchill's attention because of the extraordinary machines he'd been building. And he was asked to try and develop a magnetic mine that could be used underwater to sink the great ships of Hitler's new fleet. And he developed this thing called the limpet mine, which could be stuck onto the underside of any of Hitler's battleships, blow up and sink the ship. And the beauty of the limpet mine, because it was a magnetic mine, was it didn't just work on ships, it worked on anything that was made of metal. So it could be used on turbines, it could be used on U-boats, anything. So it became an absolutely superb and very devious weapon of sabotage.
He was kind of this largely unknown tinkerer before this department, correct?
He was a tinkerer. He was eccentric. All his neighbors said he cut a rather comical figure when they saw him wandering around the streets, disheveled. He always looked a total mess wherever he went. But Cecil Clark had served in the First World War in an explosives battalion. And he now turned all his thoughts and all his energies into working out highly devious ways to strike back at Hitler's army.
There's a great scene in the book in the early days of this secret unit when Prime Minister Churchill invites members of the team to his country estate to demonstrate a prototype, essentially, of an anti-tank weapon. And French General Charles de Gaulle is there. Tell us how that demonstration went.
Yeah, you see, Churchill absolutely loved to have a look at these prototype weapons. He loved to see them exploding. So, yes, indeed, he invited General de Gaulle to come and watch. And, of course, Churchill absolutely detested Charles de Gaulle. And it was very funny, when they set off this new prototype missile, it almost hit de Gaulle in the head and would have blown him to pieces. And some of the men there were joking that Churchill had actually bribed one of them to have a go at de Gaulle while he was there.
But actually, Churchill was quite impressed with how the prototype went.
Well, Churchill, from the very outset, was impressed with these individuals, impressed with their creativity. And he felt that with the rigid sort of military army that Hitler had constructed, there was one thing that Britain had in its favor, and that was creativity. Mm-hmm. That if you could come up with a creative solution to this enormous problem, then you had a hope of striking back, which is why he liked these colorful figures who could just dream up highly unconventional weapons, it has to be said.
There was also Colin Gubbins. He was this inventive Scotsman. Talk about what he brought to the project and to the team.
Colin Gubbins was, from a very early age, he'd been very interested in unorthodox warfare. He'd served in the trenches of the First World War, seen the horror of war in the trenches. He'd then served a very dirty war against the Bolsheviks in Russia. He'd then gone to fight against Sinn Féin in Ireland. And he'd studied all sorts of unorthodox fighters, particularly Al Capone and his Chicago gangsters. He thought the way they use their Tommy guns was absolutely brilliant. And he was brought on board to set up an organization, highly secret organization, whose exclusive goal was to explore guerrilla warfare and sabotage and how Hitler's army could best be targeted. So Colin Gubbins really was instrumental in setting up what was to become known as the Special Operations Executive. And he also brought on board this half a dozen geniuses to dream up this new ungentlemanly form of warfare.
Gubbins is essentially a pioneer in special operations, and the fact that his story is so relatively unknown today speaks to the fact, doesn't it, that the British public still kind of wrestle with the whole idea of ungentlemanly warfare.
Well, you know, in 1940, there was a debate in the House of Commons about how Britain should fight the war against Hitler. And it's extraordinary when you hear a member of parliament after member of parliament stand up and say that war it should be fought by the rule book, you know, that war was a little bit like cricket, only it used weapons. But others beg to differ, and Colin Gubbins was one of them. He said, no, when you're fighting against an enemy as devious and nasty and dangerous as the Nazis, then you simply had to tear up the rule book and anything went, basically. And that was to become his sort of creed throughout the whole of the Second World War, is that whatever the Nazis did, the British were going to fight nastier and dirtier. But of course, this was highly controversial. Many figures in the establishment, certainly in the regular army, they thought this was absolutely appalling. And so the whole idea of special operations and the various men that worked for it had to be kept completely secret throughout the duration of the war.
We're talking about creating booby traps, improvised explosive devices, using assassinations, dirty bombs. I mean, the regular British army was a bit aghast at using some of these tactics.
They were aghast. They were appalled. They tried to have the special operations, those who knew about them, tried to have them shut down. But what Churchill did is he turned one of the weapons development centres, which was to become a key centre in developing very nasty weapons of war, he converted it into an organization called MD1. It was Ministry of Defense One, and he was Minister of Defense. It answered only to him. He financed it privately. They opened a secret bank account into which he tipped enormous amounts of money. He gave the men their own country house very near Bletchley Park, which some of your listeners may have heard of, where the Enigma code was broken. And so in this house called the Furs, a small number of highly brilliant inventors gathered and started to develop some of the most devious weapons of war ever developed.
There were some incredible missions. They helped assassinate one of Hitler's top lieutenants, Reinhard Heydrich. They blew up power plants, damaged docks, and other sabotage. What mission stands out for you?
There are two that I think are really important. The first you mentioned is the assassination of Heydrich in Prague. This was Hitler's right-hand man, his chosen favorite. The other mission was the destruction of the Norsk Hydro factory in Norway. Now, Hitler was desperate to get his hands on an atomic bomb. The only way he could do this was to use heavy water, which was produced in Norway at the Norsk Hydro factory. The British were desperate to destroy this factory. It was absolutely critical to deny Hitler an atomic bomb. They tried any number of missions. They tried to bomb it from the air. They sent commandos in. They all ended in disaster. And in desperation, Churchill turned to Colin Gubbins and said, "Over to you." Colin Gubbins trained a team of seven Norwegians, gave them bespoke weaponry, and dropped them into Norway in the depths of midwinter. And it was truly the most extraordinary sabotage operation. They climbed up this ravine, they broke into the factory, they planted their explosives, the limpet mine, incidentally, that Cecil Clark had developed, onto the machinery of this factory. They blew it up, and then, amazingly, they got away and made it back to England. And even the man who ran the whole of German operations in Norway, when he came to inspect the damage, even he said, "This is the most extraordinary act of sabotage I've ever seen."
In reading your book, it's clear some of these missions saved lives. I mean, there's the horrific story in France, where an RAF commander insisted on aerial bombing of a Nazi-held factory. They got the grid coordinates wrong, and the RAF killed hundreds of French civilians. Later on, saboteurs took out the whole factory with no civilian deaths.
This was Colin Gubbins' argument all along. He was always in conflict with Bomber Command, which simply wanted to bomb Germany into submission from the air. Colin Gubbins said this is an appalling waste of civilian lives. People were getting killed for nothing. He said it's much better to send in a small team with a bag of explosives and do these highly targeted raids, hit-and-run raids, on factories and on bridges, etc. And one of these was indeed the attack on the Peugeot factory. This was Europe's biggest industrial plant, the Peugeot car factory, which had been taken over by the Germans, and they were using it to produce tanks and armoured vehicles and planes and what have you. Colin Gubbins sent in a man called Harry Ray, a saboteur, who got together a small team of men. They went into the factory one night and they planted limpet mines and explosives on all the key items of machinery in that factory and blew it to pieces. It was, again, a consummate act of sabotage that caused unbelievable damage for the Germans.
Giles Milton's new book is Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, The Mavericks Who Plotted Hitler's Defeat. Giles, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.